Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Awakenings on Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Michelle Mache, and you heard just a little bit of overtone chanting there by Jill Purse, a former guest that was on here. And delightful being. I like to play a little bit of something to kind of get us into the mode or the mood of our show. Awakenings is an interactive live internet radio show that focuses on grounding the spiritual process of awakening. It's a place to connect in spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically, and to discuss how we're traversing this time of individual and collective transition and change on the material plane. Awakenings airs live through Blog Talk Radio as well as Cosmic Dimensions Radio. So I want to welcome everyone to the program and welcome those that will be listening later in the archives. I want to say that all of you are part of what's making Awakenings part of the converging flow of awareness and consciousness. This truly is a place to map this collective transition. We are in a very, very special time, a time like no other. And in a sense, it is perhaps a time of a lot of challenge, perhaps difficulty, uncertainty, but it's also time to be the seeker again or see through the eyes of a child, yet with the awareness and wisdom of an inner sage, if you will. So it's a wonderful time of converging not only externally, but converging within ourselves. This converging flow is not just happening externally, but many more parts of us are being expressed. Many more parts of us are coming into full self-expression. And that takes a bit of balancing. But part of what I feel the key is to be able to do this or facilitate this or allow this converging flow also within oneself, as literally, if you will, our DNA is changing. Our molecular structure is changing. We are up-leveling, up-shifting. There is an upgrading or updating of our inner software that is taking place right now. So a lot of these changes are biochemical. They're not just, it's all biochemical if you think about it. It's all energetic. But it's manifesting or expressing in different forms of our life, different ways that we're living. We have the chance to live more self-expressed. We have the chance to live more realized. And there are people from all sectors, all walks of life that are chronicling this for us, doing the research for us. They're bringing their piece, if you will, to the puzzle or to the transition. And so this piece and part of the puzzle that each of us has, we each have a piece to this. This is part of that awakening, is that you have the piece within you. Exactly what you have this lifetime, this dimension is needed for this perfect unfolding. And that's why Awakenings also hosts a lot of interviews with scientists, spiritualists, metaphysicians, astrologers, those that use perhaps the oracles to see, those that perhaps work on the mental-emotional realm, so that this converging is taking in all parts and all aspects of us as individuals and as life forms. Because the whole, if God, if you will, is shifting, the all that is, the whole of the life force animating energy is shifting, is in this shift of growth, awareness, and change. And so it is, in a sense, a time to be that seeker, that searcher, that explorer, your own scientist, to get involved, to get integrated into your own life, get more into your own life. Because as you're living more self-expressed, you will have and experience more fulfillment in this time of transition and change. The guides are always saying new forms are needed. What are those forms for you? Well, our next guest that we're going to be bringing on, one of the forms for him was research. And as a scientist, he's bringing a lot of research into this collective and individual transition and change. We need people that map this. Today we're going to have on Dr. Rick Strassman, who actually began human research with psychedelic or hallucinogenic drugs in the United States back in the 90s, back in 1990, actually. And these studies actually investigated the effects of DMT, an extremely short-acting and powerful psychedelic. And during the project's 5 years, he administered approximately 400 doses of DMT to 60 human volunteers. Now, this research took place in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he was a professor of psychiatry. Now, what's interesting about this was that he began to see that this was really a cutting-edge brain science, looking at the psychopharmacology of serotonin, bringing that together to begin to see what is the spiritual component, what is the unfolding, and that there was this spirit molecule, if you will, that was revealed. I find it very, very fascinating. He's also the author of a couple of very, very leading-edge books, The Spirit Molecule, and a co-author of Inner Paths. So we're going to give him a call. And also, anybody, if you have questions, you know I love people calling in or questions in the chat. If you have questions in the chat, just please type in caps or put the question mark icon so I can catch it. And then if you'd like to call in to listen, the number is 347-539-5122. And if you'd like to call in and have questions, the number is 347-539-5122. Same number. You can also just press the number 1 on your phone, and then I'll know that you have a question. But that may or may not work. So I may just, if I see you someone online, I may.
This is Rick.
Hello, Rick. You're on Awakenings, live with Awakenings. This is Michelle Mache.
Great.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Excited. You've got packed listeners. Packed
good.
Listeners.
Well, so when do we start?
Right now.
Right now. Okay. And when do we go till?
You're live now.
Okay.
Go to a little bit after 1:30.
A little after 1. Okay. Like about an hour.
Okay.
Or like 55 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
Go ahead.
Is this being broadcast over the radio or just over the web?
It's over the web, and it's, there's quite a few podcast stations that it's being broadcast live right now.
Oh, okay.
And then archived on iTunes. So you're on live right now.
Okay.
Yeah, great. So glad you could, I did a bit of an intro to let people know a little bit about you, but a lot of people already have known about your research, which is great. And first, though, how are you doing today?
Good. I'm kind of knee-deep in preparation for working on my next book, actually.
You have another one coming out?
I just, signed a contract with the same publisher who published the DMT book and Inner Paths.
Okay.
The publisher is called Inner Traditions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this next book I'm working on is going to be about prophecy. So I'm kind of getting myself prepared. I've got a deadline now that I need to get the manuscript in by. So.
Yeah, I was reading that. That can be good though, right? That can be create a little more inspiration.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was just kind of dawdling until I got a deadline. So I have a deadline now, so I'm now working on it, pretty much all the time.
That's great. Well, let's dive in. And those of you that are, I see people are just, more people are coming in the chat as well as online. So I want to reintroduce Dr. Rick Strassman, who is co-author of Inner Paths to Outer Space and author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And we're just going to dive right in. I'm fascinated by how you came about this path, and which I'm going to term, in, you know, loosely, your own awakening to go into this direction. That way, that our listeners can get a little bit of background, if you don't mind. So, how are you drawn to this research?
Oh, I guess it just depends on, you know, how, you know, far back you want to go with my interests. I suppose.
Let's go back. Let's go, Rick.
Yeah. Oh, as a kid, like as a teenager anyway, I was very interested in fireworks. Mm-hmm. I built bombs and made fireworks, all different kinds of colors and things. Yeah, and and actually most of the parents of the kids on my block stopped letting them play with me after a while because it was just a little too scary over at my house. So, you know, so I actually started college as a chemistry major. I wanted to begin my own fireworks factory. But everybody told me, you know, there was no future in that, and I was smart, and I had to go to medical school. So, you know, I really kind of was not that interested at the time in going into med school. I was more interested in, you know, consciousness. And I had, you know, as an undergraduate, I had taken a number of classes at Stanford where I did my last 2 years of undergraduate work. And I was introduced to Buddhism at that time. This was in the early 1970s. And, you know, physiological psychology and, you know, some of the new sleep research that was coming out. And also at around that same time, you know, people were beginning to study the psychedelic drugs, which obviously were very quick undeniable ways of, you know, getting into quite highly altered states of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so with my interest in chemistry, my interest in bright colors and fireworks, my interest in, you know, physiological psychology and also in Buddhism, I was, you know, starting to, you know, determine a career course or a career path that would be able to take into account all of these, you know, all of these interests.
Mm-hmm.
All of these interests all kind of pointed into the same direction, which was, I suppose, for the lack of a better phrase, you know, the physiology of mystical experience, or, you know, the pharmacology of spiritual states.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took me some time to get all of the academic training necessary and to go through a lot of the interpersonal work that I had to be able to get started with this mm-hmm. field of work. But, you know, I went to med school and trained in psychiatry and, you know, did some fellowship training in psychopharmacology research. I started off with an interest in the pineal gland as an area of clinical research. So I spent a number of years looking into the role of melatonin in human physiology. I was kind of hoping that melatonin would be, you know, psychoactive, but it actually, you know, turned out it's only, you know, kind of sedating.
Right.
After a couple of years of working with melatonin, and it didn't really turn out to be all that spectacular from a you know, psychological point of view, that's when I changed directions and embarked, you know, directly into the DMT work.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting as you speak, though, I'm thinking, because with the fireworks and such, not only there is a physiological experience with fireworks, you know, you can, it's not just visual, it's very kinesthetic. It's, you feel it within, you know, the body.
Well, yeah, you know, it's, well, also it's an emotional experience too.
Yeah.
There's, you know, there's the thrill, there's the fear, you know, there's the excitation, all those
mm-hmm.
things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes, you know, so I kind of traded external fireworks, as it were, for internal fireworks.
Exactly. And I find it fascinating too with the pineal gland, of course. And if you're studying Eastern traditions, it's said as that is more activated or utilized, that is the doorway to that higher consciousness. Do you have thoughts of that, or our expanded consciousness?
Yeah. Well, you know, it isn't only the Eastern, you know, religious, you know, physiologies that talk about the pineal gland. Even Kabbalah has got, you know, the location of a spiritual kind of center on the top of the head and in the middle of the skull. So the pineal, either in an abstract, you know, kind of sense, or actually as a as a, you know, physiological organ. It's, you know, been an area of interest of spiritual kinds of traditions for, you know, for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
One point I'm always, you know, kind of called on is, you know, there isn't really any objective evidence yet that the pineal gland makes DMT or any other psychedelic drugs. In the DMT book, I marshal quite a bit of circumstantial evidence, but it still remains to be determined if the pineal gland makes DMT.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be frosting on the cake in quite a few ways. But even if that the pineal gland does not make DMT, you know, we do know that it is made in other organs in the body, particularly in the lungs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we do? That it is?
Well, yes, we do. Yeah, yeah.
Now, what is the connection there, is there, to serotonin?
Well, so DMT, which stands for dimethyltryptamine, it's a chemical cousin of serotonin.
Okay.
It's quite closely chemically related.
Mm-hmm.
DMT comes from a compound which is called tryptamine,
mm-hmm.
and it's got a couple of methyl groups which are then attached to it, and then it becomes, you know, dimethyltryptamine. But the same ingredients that go into the formation of serotonin also are involved in the production of DMT as well, and also a number of the receptors that DMT activates in the brain are specific subtypes of the receptors for serotonin as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they're closely linked both, you know, physiologically and structurally. You know, they look alike and they act on, you know, the same parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm. So you said there's and it also with the pineal gland, it could also be said that that's connecting to more of the intuitive realm or doorway into that. What did you find in your overall research with researching this? Were people naturally drawn to expanded states of consciousness and spiritual awareness or spiritual integration in this research? Did that seem to be a natural component and byproduct?
It could be helpful if I kind of lay out the study a bit.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's actually strange in terms of how long ago that study took place. I began the paperwork, which, you know, took 2 years, to get all of the permits in order to begin the study in 1988, over 20 years ago now. And I started the study in the end of 1990. And I performed a number of research studies between 1990 and 1995, and I kind of wrapped up, stage of things in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's been quite a while. Even though I still get quite a bit of email and phone calls and interviews, and
mm-hmm.
the book sales are doing quite well. But in any event, we gave DMT intravenously. As a rule on the street anyway, it's smoked as the freebase, kind of like freebase cocaine or smoke. Mm-hmm. But obviously, the you know, the effects are quite different.
Mm-hmm.
I just used experienced, you know, psychedelic users because I was interested in them, you know, being able to handle their drugs, as it were, because because these studies were taking place on a research unit of a busy university hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I received financial support from both a division of the Masons, actually, called the Scottish Rite Foundation for Schizophrenia Research. That was my first grant. And
wow.
I then got some grants, you know, from the National Institutes of Health. They were interested in, what's going on when, you know, people experience DMT.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting aspects of DMT is that it's you know, made in the body. So when this was discovered, you know, quite a few years ago in the 1960s or so, everybody was interested in, you know, is there some kind of role for DMT in the naturally occurring altered states of consciousness like schizophrenia?
Mm-hmm.
So they worked at the metabolic pathways for the formation and the breakdown of DMT. And, you know, they gave it to a number of people over the years in the 1960s. And even though all of the studies stopped in humans in the early 1970s, animal studies continued apace. And there's a huge amount of information out there on the pharmacology of these compounds in lower animals, which needed to be confirmed in humans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I, you know, kind of use that angle,
mm-hmm.
To justify, you know, reopening the area of human psychedelic research. It had been closed for almost 20 years or even
mm-hmm.
more. And also, even though it isn't an especially, you know, popular abused or, you know, psychedelic street drug, it's kind of the prototype of a whole category of compounds which are called the tryptamines, which include
mm-hmm.
LSD and ibogaine and, you know, psilocybin mushrooms and things.
Mm-hmm.
So
we have tryptamines in our system, right?
Yeah. Well, we have DMT.
So
DMT is in the bloodstream. There's also another compound like DMT, which is called 5-methoxy-DMT.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tryptamine, and that's quite psychedelic as well.
Now, we do have a question in the chat, if I could put this to you, Rick. Is there a way to increase DMT in our system?
Well, we just don't know.
You don't know?
There are all these, you know, kinds of, you know, technologies that one could engage in, you know, like meditation,
mm-hmm.
extreme exercise, you know, even dreams, you know, which are quite psychedelic. And a number of those states, you know, have got resemblance, you know, to what happens if you give somebody DMT.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, you know, kind of put, you know, two and two together, you would think that perhaps there is an increase in, you know, naturally occurring DMT. You know, but the concentrations in the bloodstream of DMT are quite low, and it's quite hard to measure.
Mm.
And it's quite hard, you know, to distinguish between levels in one person compared, you know, to another, or schizophrenic compared to a normal volunteer. I'm currently collaborating with a group at Louisiana State University that's developing a new super sensitive, you know, means of being able to, you know, to measure DMT.
Mm-hmm.
It ought to be at least 100 times, you know, more sensitive, you know, than older methods of being able to measure it. So I think once we've got, that assay, you know, kind of well established, I think we'll be able to start determining if specific, you know, things that you do, which, you know, cause altered states of consciousness, are related to increases of naturally occurring DMT or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, like, well, you know, for example, if you can establish, you know, normal values of DMT in a normal person during, you know, normal waking consciousness, it would be extremely interesting, you know, to just compare levels in the evening as compared to the morning, you know, because of the phenomena of, you know, the dream state. Yeah, and, you know, meditation and all kinds of, you know, other things can stimulate, you know, kind of, you know, can stimulate, you know, psychedelic kinds of experiences.
Well, meditation, huge. Definitely. Huge.
Yeah. And, you know, if, you know, there is some overlap in the phenomenology between what happens when you use DMT and when you meditate, then you can conclude perhaps that there is, you know, some relationship between the subjective state of meditation and, you know, something going on in the body in terms of naturally occurring DMT.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me that there's, you know, with whatever the state of consciousness, whether induced through DMT or perhaps naturally increasing through, like you said, the extreme exercise or the meditation, there seems to be this component of the body becoming more relaxed, but the brain functionality increasing. So increased awareness and almost a hypersensitivity. As opposed to what many used to believe, that it was a tuning out, you know. Turning on or tuning in is really revving things up to come into to more awareness.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting in terms of REM sleep, which is when most people dream. You know, it is, you know, quite an active state. Your pulse goes up and your respiration goes up and your blood pressure goes up, you know, but you're paralyzed at the same time, you know, so you can't act out what's going on in your dreams. You know, so DMT actually, you know, causes an increase in pulse and respiration and blood pressure as well. You know, so that's why I'm, you know, keen on, you know, determining if you know, there is an increase of DMT that occurs during REM.
During that time.
Yeah, that'd be a very easy thing to do.
Now, we did have another, we have some people online, but we'll get to the phones. a question in the chat, which, by the way, Rick, is also known as the Sacred Space of Empowerment. It's been renamed. Okay. If you can touch upon or explain the release of DMT upon death in the 49th day of gender gestation period. Why is there so much release at this time?
Oh, well, you know, that's speculative too. You know, one of the problems with my DMT book is I speculate freely, and I combine speculation with data. And, you know, sometimes it's been hard.
Well, you're getting laughed in the chat with that too, because obviously he's read the book.
Yeah, because, you know, some people, it's been kind of difficult, you know, for them to distinguish between speculation and data. So the increase of DMT that occurs at death is speculation. You know, we just don't know. And, you know, that's another, you know, study that would be extremely easy to do, you know, with a new assay to be able to measure levels of DMT in the blood or the urine. But there are quite a few, you know, similarities between, you know, the near-death experience and what happens when you get DMT, you know, so that's why I speculated, that there could be, you know, some elevation in, you know, normal levels of DMT in the dying process. So the 49-day thing is also kind of speculation as well, but it correlates, you know, with the time required in the embryo for the appearance of the pineal gland, and also, you know, the appearance of, you know, the differentiation of the male versus female gonads, and also in a number of different schools of Buddhism, you know, there's a, you know, period of, you know, 49 days, you know, which elapses between the death of one person and, you know, theoretically anyway, the rebirth of that individual into another body, you know. So I kind of tied together the spiritual and, you know, the sexual and, you know, the soul aspect of things in humans with that, 49-day coincidence or correspondence or, whatever you want to call it. But that is speculation, too. Mm-hmm. Even though it was really fun to speculate about.
That's good.
It isn't completely crazy. These studies could be done.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
What I often think, and of course I'm not coming from a scientific background, thank goodness, because I don't have to say we have to do the research, but I think sometimes the speculation is intuitive, an intuitive hit or knowingness that later is going to be proved.
Yeah, well, that could be. And, that's especially going to be, the case in this new book that I'm, currently working on, is I'm going to be extremely careful about what's speculation and what's fact.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've spent a fair amount of time, since the DMT book came out, explaining what's been speculation and, what is data.
Mm-hmm. Well, it reminds me of... years ago, my background of transpersonal therapy and working with repatterning, that we knew that impressions in the womb later would create a pattern and would create a certain behavior or proclivity of a behavior starting in the womb and then to about age 8. And I think a few years ago, probably 5-6 years ago, Harvard came out with this wonderful research and validated that and said that. But so I think sometimes, that, and what is that line, perhaps in science to bridging spirituality or intuitive awareness, what is that line that sometimes gets crossed, I think even in science, where you're so steeped in your research that you perhaps are getting these intuitive hits or knowingness that later will be proved,
Well, of course, yeah, and, any kind of major steps that occur in, which occur in the, scientific arena usually occur through some kind of intuitive leap or another.
Okay. So it's almost there's like the protocol or you're setting it up, and then it sounds like that gives a platform for that intuitive leap.
Arrived at speculation, right.
Right.
But, it's informed speculation. We gave a lot of DMT, and I learned quite a bit about it, and we have quite a bit of data. So there's kind of wild-eyed speculation, and there's informed speculation. Hopefully, mine is more on the side of level-headed speculation.
Mm-hmm. So then, Rick, from there, because obviously, that opened up a whole, it sounds like a lot of questions. There were some things answered, but also a lot of questions with this research. What do you feel that you came away with in this research?
Well, there were a number of things. DMT, clearly has profound effects. We gave a few hundred doses of DMT to quite a few dozen volunteers. And it's incredibly profound kinds of responses that, people had. They left their bodies within just a few heartbeats of receiving the drug. They entered these incredible spaces or states or worlds or, realms, which were, I suppose, for lack of any better term, spiritual in, nature.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes the spaces that the volunteers entered were inhabited, by beings, that interacted with them, corresponded with them, asked them questions, and gave them information.
Mm-hmm.
Some people had spiritual, enlightenment sort of experiences. Others understood the development of, consciousness from God. Others understood, the development of, reality from consciousness. All kinds of huge experiences. The first study that we did, it only involved giving, it only involved giving people a number of different doses of DMT. We weren't really actually, interested in that, determining the specific, pharmacology of the drug. So once we started to, you know, blockade, you know, this receptor and antagonize that receptor, started to get a bit uncomfortable, you know, both for me and for the volunteers. You know, and they were kind of being exposed to combinations of medications I wasn't so comfortable with, and it was kind of like, you know, it was kind of like it was almost as if, you know, the studies were moving from a spiritual point of view to a purely pharmacological point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we started becoming, you know, more interested in their brains than the, you know, than their minds or their spirits at the time. You know, so there were a number of, you know, circumstances, you know, that came to bear upon me and upon the research. You know, they made it obvious that it was time to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so it started you going in. It sounds like it started you going in another direction.
Well, I, you know, was not quite prepared for the profundity of the states that the volunteers were entering. You know, I had a long-standing relationship with the Zen Buddhist community for over 20 years or so. Experienced and quite well, you know, trained in, you know, psychoanalytic, you know, kinds of, you know, psychotherapy and understanding psychopathology, you know, from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I also understood, you know, the brain and its, you know, and its, you know, pharmacology and, you know, the way the DMT worked. But just, you know, confronted with people's experiences, I really wasn't able to explain them either, you know, to my satisfaction or to the volunteers', you know, satisfaction. It was way beyond Buddhism. It was way beyond psychoanalysis, and it was way beyond brain chemistry. You know, so after kind of closing up shop, I've spent a long time, you know, looking for, you know, I'm looking for some way to understand what it was that the volunteers were going through, and also, you know, some context, you know, some spiritual context to place those experiences and, you know, worldview that seemed to be opened up, you know, through their exposure to DMT.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my view of spirituality, I think, was quite immature at the time. You know, so that was one thing I learned, you know, which I wasn't quite expecting, but, you know, you have to be open, you know, to the results of your studies. So, so that's one of the, you know, discoveries that I made.
So it seemed like there was a deepening for you as well. You know, you said the profundity, so you were, it really was a gateway, you know, it really came out a doorway there. So we do have another question really quick. Is DMT a drug you can legally get?
No, it's what's called a Schedule I drug, you know,
okay.
So it's in the same category as, you know, things like heroin or LSD, those sorts of drugs. You know, you can extract DMT from plants, and, you know, there is plenty of information out there on the internet about how to extract DMT from plants.
Mm-hmm. And then somebody is asking also in the chat, if it might have been covered already, about taking melatonin when they traveled for work to help with jet lag.
That's kind of an established, you know, use of melatonin these days is for sleep and especially, you know, for the disturbed sleep that comes from jet lag.
Mm-hmm. I find that 5-HTP.
Right, 500.
You know,
for 5-hydroxytryptophan.
Yeah, the tryptophan, wonderful. So,
yeah.
And actually, I think induces or creates more serotonin.
Well, it increases levels of serotonin, and also I think it may increase levels of melatonin as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of. You can see, and why I'm asking this, part of this, with this individual and collective shift we're in, Rick, there's of late been more physical to physiological experiences. I don't know if you're finding this personally or with people you connect with on your travels, but sleep patterns being disrupted, people either sleeping a lot or not sleeping a lot, and having a lot of, you know, and not just negative, high create mode, wanting to get a lot done, finding that they're able to process more or get more done, but then, you know, the sleep kind of goes out window.
Yeah, I hadn't quite really noticed that. Well, so that's kind of a pattern, you know, that you're noticing?
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, in fact, even I've talked to people that have even had almost like unelicited kriyas, movements where, and almost like growing up pains, like when kids are growing up, they'll have shooting pains.
Right.
And, you know, of course, this is just anecdotal. I'm not doing some big research on it, but just from people that I've talked to, you know, all over the world, actually, these kinds of symptoms are coming up, and nothing's physically or physiologically wrong. But there does seem to be some physiological and physical component to the shift that we're all in.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, this whole 2012 thing's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there ought to be, you know, some kind of, you know, physiological correspondence to everybody thinking about some, you know, major, you know, change in consciousness that is going to take place then. So, you know, it could be that the sleep disturbances are, you know, some kind of, you know, harbinger of, you know, some more extensive, you know, physiological changes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some say, in a sense, that our inner software, our mind is being, you know, if there is more use of an expanded consciousness, or people are becoming more aware or intuitive or just heightened sense, of course, that could cause those kinds of, you know, disturbances as well. Yeah, it's interesting to chronicle, though, that it is. I'm always amazed because, you know, things can tend to happen to people that you're around. We can have similar experiences. But then when you talk to people that aren't involved, you know, in this type of conscious work or awareness, that are having similar experiences and that are even, you know, non-local, that are not local to you, you start really looking and saying, well, maybe something is really happening here. And in a sense, because you said it earlier with the, you know, the physiological and psychological, you know, changes in your research, why wouldn't a shift, if it's going to have mental, emotional changes and material, like what's happening, you know, in our, in, you know, world of government and banking and institutions, why wouldn't there be a physical and physiological component to our
Well, there has to be, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I suppose one could spend a lot of time, you know, discussing, you know, what comes first. But, you know, mm-hmm. there is a correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, through brain chemistry, you know, you can cause extraordinary, you know, changes in consciousness.
Mm.
You know, by smoking this drug or injecting it, you know, you're kind of transported to alien realms, which is, you know, in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
So they're close by in some form or another, you mm-hmm. know, whether they're in the brain or they're being received by the brain in a new state of awareness or, you know, what exactly. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's impossible to exclude, you know, either the, you know, consciousness or you know, the physiology aspects of the equation.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good point. Like, you know, that you have the inner paths to the outer space or outer world. Is it something that's happening within us, or, you know, it brings up that, or are we responding to something?
Yeah. And, you know, I, you know, with the kind of training and the kind of background that I had, I was kind of, you know, steeped in a tradition that it was all occurring in our brains or in our minds, you mm-hmm. know, that they, you know that these experiences, you know, were not, you know, the perception of an external reality. And, you know, that is, you know, and, you know, so that viewpoint was the thing that, you know, caused the most, you know, friction between my volunteers and me, is, you know, me describing it or interpreting their experiences as internal and as internally generated. But the volunteers were all quite adamant in stating that it was an external reality that they were just able, to perceive in their altered state. So any kind of system, I think, has got to, you know, take into account at least the possibility, you know, that all of this stuff is occurring externally, you know, to us. It isn't, you know, dependent upon us, for its, for its existence. Mm-hmm. You know, we can dip into it and
right.
We can observe it at times, but it's, you know, going on independently of us. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would tend to agree. Otherwise, everything it would be a projection. But if
right.
Right? But other if it's,
well, that's what. Right. Yeah, you know, and you know, that's, you know, kind of the psychoanalytic view and even the Buddhist point of view. But I don't think so.
No, I don't either. I think there's
yeah.
We have perception too. I think we can perceive something occurring or happening to us or with us, and in that perception, we can be engaged in it.
Right.
Drawn on into it or trigger, but I agree. Although, to me, if everything's just projection, then we would be very egocentric.
Well, you know, it's called hubris. You know, kind
yeah,
of. You know,
yeah. Exactly.
Know yes.
Yeah. Exactly. We do have a caller. Let's see who's. Hello, Conscious. You're on Awakenings with Dr. Rick Strassman.
Supreme blessings and respect. How are you doing?
Great. You're going to have to speak distinctly, because are you calling it via computer?
Yes. Can I be heard?
I can hear you. Rick, can you hear
yeah.
me?
Yeah, I can hear him pretty well. Yeah.
Okay. How are you
Welcome
doing,
to the program.
Dr. Strassman? Thank you. God, how are you doing as well? I just had a question, and I'm going to make it brief because I have to depart. I just want to thank both of you and tell you I appreciate it. But I was wondering, as far as like the spiritual aspect of perceiving things and classifying things in maybe like the linear analytical aspect that we use within our social communities. Okay, you remember when the church, the spiritual aspect, basically blocked the opportunity for scientific genius to basically be able to share information without them being able to validate it based on religion? Do you see a point where now the scientific community and the spiritual community actually realize the codependency that exists with like both of them in order to get to like the actual facts concerning things?
I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's quite happening yet. You know, within the scientific communities, you know, there's a new field called neurotheology. But it still isn't really, you know, giving, you know, full credence or full equal billing to the spiritual aspect of things. It's, you know, more interested in explaining spiritual experiences through the mechanics of brain physiology, so it isn't really truly, you know, taking into account both the spiritual and, you know, you know, the biological on equal footing, and you know, within the spiritual communities, it's even, you know, further afield. You know, there isn't all, you know, that much interest. Within the spiritual, you know, traditions, there isn't, you know, any real, you know, rigorous interest in, you know, in terms of a combining of the two, you know, sets of theories or, mm-hmm. you know, two, you know, sets of, you know, tools of, you know, discourse. It's occurring in, you know, it is occurring, you know, more within, you know, the scientific community, but still I think it's, you know, it's still quite heavily weighted, towards the biological.
Mm-hmm. So it's still parallel. There's not as much intersecting as what I'm hearing you say.
Right, right. They're kind of, yeah, that's a good way to put it, is, you know, they're both kind of going in, you know, parallel. There isn't, you know, there's some contact, but it still is, you know, it still is rather tentative, you know, it still is rather tentative from the scientific point of view, and, you know, from the religious point of view, it isn't even tentative. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's hegemony involved, you know, like turf.
Yeah,
you
that's know, like, right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So the brain, you know, chemistry guys are all going to kind of say it's our turf, and, you know, the people into spirituality or organized religions are going to say there's their turf. So I think there needs to be, you know, the development of, you know, like a real, you know, serious, respectful, you know, kind of a, you know, hybridization of the two fields. You know, like mm-hmm. You know, clinical spirituality or, you know, you know, spiritual psychopharmacology, but I don't think that we're quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be a resistance to it in a way, even.
Well, that's because people have got a lot at stake.
Okay.
So they don't like to share.
Is that what's happening? I wondered why there seems to be a resistance to combining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I think it's, you know, based on, it is kind of, you know, territorial. Also, though, I think that it would be kind of scary if the two fields really respectfully began, you know, to take each other seriously. You know, not just that, oh, yeah, spiritual experiences happen, but, you know, what is the spiritual experience? And you know, where does it come from? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's the message? And those kinds of things. You know, it would, you know, need to step out of the, you know, physiological or the spiritual to kind of, you know, make things, you know, look a lot more, you know, complete or integrated, you know, that they are, you know, right now.
Mm. Okay. Conscious, does that help? Your answer?
Yes, I appreciate it. I was thinking about what he stated, and I always noticed something when you look at the more ancient religions or cultivative teachings. In all actuality, they were basically based on spiritual science, but only in a select group of individuals knew like that level. Then they had the lower intellectualized level, which would be the religion for the multitude. I think that level is basically what would be in opposition of the science, because the science should be connected next to spirituality, not religion. It should be the spiritual.
Well,
science,
and you know, in a number of these ancient religions, you know, there wasn't any difference between, you know, what was spiritual and, you know, what was physical.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Exactly. So I'm wondering if we're dovetailing back. You're welcome. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we have another caller. Hi, 510-355. You're on the program with Dr. Rick Strassman.
Hi, Michelle. This is Amber.
Oh, hello, Amber.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Strassman.
Hi.
Hi. So I put that long question in the chat room, and so now I'm going to read it.
Okay.
But this is very, it's like you asked me to just call in.
Well, she had a long question, you know, people call in, some people put questions in the chat, and then this was like three lines.
Okay, this is like a small book, this question.
That's right.
I apologize. I'm long-winded. I am a little long-winded at times. It might be my Aquarian moon. But anyway, so I'm just curious as to how does the pineal gland and DMT relate to the healing of trauma? And I say that to say, how does the expansion of consciousness or connection or activation of the pineal gland affect the physical body or the earthly experience?
Yeah. Well, you know, like I was talking about earlier, the whole pineal connection is, you know, kind of, you know, speculative at this point, in, you know, terms of us really knowing if there is any DMT that's made in the pineal. You know, but there is DMT that is made in the body, especially in the lungs. And, you know, there are, you know, there were a couple of the volunteers in my study, you know, that had experienced, you know, significant amounts of, you know, psychological sorts of trauma as kids. And, you know, they were able to work through a fair amount of their reaction and their, you know, and, you know, the kinds of, you know, symptoms and, you know, problems, you know, that had, you know, kind of developed as a result of their being, you know, traumatized when younger, under the influence of DMT.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's this Amazonian mixture of two plants, which is called ayahuasca.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the visionary component in this, you know, psychedelic combination of plants is DMT. And, you know, there are quite a few anecdotal, you know, stories out there of people undergoing, you know, quite profound psychological healing under the influence of ayahuasca. So I think, you know, one of the treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder is, you know, gradual and controlled exposure, you know, to trauma. You know, the psychedelics, you know, they can be, so the experience can be kind of startling and kind of shattering and kind of, you know, traumatic, you know, but it's being experienced in a more controlled manner. And if you've got, you know, if you've got somebody in another room with you who's, you know, supervising your experience, you know, you can get, you know, to levels of, you know, trauma in a more gradual and controlled way, you know, you can expose it kind of layer by layer and, you know, make peace with it. You know, so, I think, among other things, you know, that there are some, you know, fact, you know, that there are, you know, some healing and, psychotherapeutic elements of, you know, the DMT experience as well. You know, either if you take it in from the outside or if it's being, you know, theoretically anyway, you know, generated from within.
I'm going to have to read your book. I think this is very, very interesting. And, you know, I guess just in my own experience, like just the idea of the pineal gland and like in many cultures, many esoteric and, you know, religious walks, the pineal is related to the third eye or, you know, the sight within other realms. And its ignition is, and I was just looking around at this, its ignition is induced by the rising of the Kundalini, or the raising of the earth
to meet
the upper realms. So, you know, it just seems by process of association, you know, specific hormones that are released during the dream state, the type of work that can be done in dreams, the dream space being related to the spirit realm. By process of association, we can, you know, it just, some things resonate and some things feel right and correct. And I think personally, because this is, you know, I'm researching this this is like my life path. I didn't even know this was what I was doing, but essentially it goes into, you know, working with trauma and working with, you know, those energies, the pineal and the kundalini kind of. I feel like we're in a process of urban ritual. And, you know, my experience, I do have PTSD, but there was something that happened with just a few words in my mind where a psychiatrist said there's also post-traumatic stress growth, where the body will grow, almost generate new neural pathways so that you can cope with the amount of energy coursing through your body. And I think that we're collectively in a state of shock, you know, the planet over. We've been shocking our spirits to a point of, you know, we just can't be shocked anymore. And it's very Aquarian, and it's meant to wake us up. But we're feeling the growth happening, you know, physically in my body for the past 3 weeks, really, or to a month and a half. Physically in my body, I feel things occurring, and it just makes sense if we have these tools, you know, just like you said to Conscious in the last call, there's a reason that science and spirituality don't want to link. There's great power in knowing not only the theory, but then the practical application, which is what the science does tell you. If we know the names of these neurons.
We need the science, right? Don't you agree? I mean, obviously, we need the science.
We need the process.
Well, yeah, you know, science is peer-reviewed and, you know, consensual, and, you know, that's crucial.
It has to be matched up. And, you know, there are, like you said, there are sects, and you are living proof of it, but there are small pockets of, you know, science attempting to bridge with spirituality, with art and creativity, because it's going to give us, it's like the masculine and the feminine. They're both going to the same thing. This is one way of getting there, and here is another. If you have both paths, we actually will arrive, you know, with the synthesis in place. So thank you, and
yeah.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, that's going to be a very interesting moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it will. And I think it's trying to dovetail back there. That's trying to be part of the converging flow of the two coming together. Now, Rick, you also...
Well, you know, it's an anti-fundamentalist perspective.
Yes.
You know, it's, you know, kind of like you're not, you know, taking the polar extremes. You're, you know, you're doing, you know, what you can to bridge and to merge and to be open-minded to each other.
Yeah, that's where we're going.
You just don't take things that, you know, literally, either as a scientist or as a, you know, spiritual person.
Right.
You have to admit that you could be wrong and you may not know what you're talking about. To seek help and advice, you know, and another point of view.
Yeah, kind of coming together. Now, Rick, you co-authored another book, and I also want to touch, I don't know if you want to mention a little bit of the inner traditions of the prophecy, but I want to touch a little bit on the inner pathways to outer space that you co-authored. Is it Slawik? Wojtowicz?
Yes.
I'm probably butchering the name.
Yeah, it's a Polish name, and it's really hard to pronounce.
Yeah. I tried.
Yeah, well, his last name is pronounced Wojtowicz.
Wojtowicz, okay.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, that Inner Path to Outer Space, you know, book was his idea. He called me a few years ago, you know, because he's extremely interested in, you know, science fiction. He's written, some science fiction stories, and he's quite a fantastic artist and illustrates, you know, science fiction books. When he came upon my DMT book, he was thinking it'd be very interesting for the science fiction community, you know, to know about, you know, the kinds of experiences that the volunteers, you know, were having on DMT, because, you know, they were kind of, you know, similar to the kinds of stories and material that, you know, that is in you know, is in works of you know, science fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, so he asked me if I'd be interested in collaborating with him on a book, you know, that kind of opened up things for more of a, you know, sci-fi community. You know, so I asked him if I could include somebody else, so that individual was Luis Eduardo Luna, who's an anthropologist who's done an extraordinary amount of, you know, work with ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. And then Luis Eduardo asked if, you know, somebody else could come on board named Edie Frexa, who's a Hungarian psychiatrist who is extremely knowledgeable about quantum physics and quantum theories about consciousness. So all of us, you know, put our heads together, and each of us, you know, contributes like a handful of, you know, chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we kind of, you know, explicate and interpret and, you know, kind of take it to the next level, the kinds of, you know, findings that emerged from our DMT work.
Mm. Yeah, it's great. It's it's that blending, going past those five senses into these other dimensional realms. That seems to be the theme here.
It's an interesting, you know, combination of points of view. The co-author whose idea the book was, has written a couple of, you know, chapters about, you know, the parallelisms and the overlap between the DMT results and what's going on within the science fiction community. Edie Frexa, you know, discusses, you know, some of the, you know, possible theories about, you know, is it possible,
mm-hmm.
You know, that we do experience other worlds when we're in an altered an altered state of conscious, you know, externally validated, you know, worlds, mm-hmm. you know, rather than only, you know, figments of the imagination or, you know, so-called hallucinations.
Of course, that goes into, where does the imagination come from? Is it something that really was experienced? Amber, do you want to stay on the line? We've got a couple of the callers, so.
Yeah. I'm going to listen through the computer. Just want to call.
Okay.
And chat.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Okay.
Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Hello, 760-746. You're on Awakenings with Dr. Rick Strassman. 760-746, you're on live on Awakenings. Are you there? Okay, they may just be listening then. We'll see. If you do have a question, I'm going to try the other. You're on the air with Awakenings. Okay. Those callers, that if you do have a question, hello?
Hello?
Hello? Yes, you're on Awakening.
Hi, can you both hear me?
Yes, did you?
Pretty well, yeah.
Okay, thank you so much. I wasn't sure if I was live or not. I'm wondering about if you have any similar kind of common experiences that you were able to tally from all the different subjects that you had the DMT research with, similar to maybe some of the findings that Stanislav Grof did in the 60s with LSD. He kind of tabulated some of the common experiences that everyone shared. Do you have similarities with that?
Yeah. So I categorize, you know, people's experiences on, you know, DMT, conceptually, you know, categorize them. Like Stan Grof did, but the categories that Stan, you know, came up with were from a specific theoretical sort of framework, that had to do with birth trauma and the birth process. And I categorized, you know, people's experiences, you know, more from the point of view of, you know, the phenomenology, you know, what were people going through, as opposed to, you know, how did what they were going through, you know, fit into a specific theoretical framework. You know, so, you know, so both of our, you know, categorization, you know, processes are good, and they're valid, and they're helpful. But, you know, each of them, you know, kind of takes a different tack. You know, like I was, you know, I categorize people's experiences along the lines of, you know, psychotherapeutic or, you know, mystical or, you know, or otherworldly, those kinds of categories. Whereas Stan categorized them as the stages of the birth process, you know, like in intrauterine, as opposed, you know, to the beginning of contractions and, you know, the beginning of delivery and, you know, then delivery.
Mm.
You know, so each of them, you know, is quite valid and, you know, quite useful, you know, but they kind of take a slightly different perspective on the phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Great question. Yeah, that's great. Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting because we can have a different approach, you know, and of course then that brings a different focus, right, Rick, to what we experience or what our results are.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm also, you know, I think it's important to, you know, distinguish, you know, between DMT and LSD that Stan studied. You know, LSD is, you know, like a 10 to, it's a, you know, 10 to, you know, 12-hour experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people respond to that over time. You know, you can begin, you know, being relaxed, or you can begin being tense, and, you know, one's personality is involved with the experience a lot more than is the case with DMT. You know, well, when we gave DMT, began to, the effects began within just a couple of heartbeats, and the you know, peak effect of the injections of DMT took place at around the 2-minute point.
Oh.
And you know, they were completely resolved within a half hour or so, as, you know, compared to LSD, which, you know, can take an hour to start, and, you know, it can, you know, peak in 3 hours or even 4, or more hours after that, and the results are still being felt, you know, 10 to 12 hours later. With a DMT experience, you just kind of hold on and observe, mm-hmm. As opposed, you know, to working with it as such, you know. So, and, you know, also LSD is, you know, made in another laboratory. It isn't a, you know, naturally occurring compound like, you know, like DMT is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are, you know, some differences anyway in, you know, the phenomenology themselves and the pharmacology too.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that it's found in the lungs.
DMT is, you know, so DMT is, you know, made in the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's been known for, you know, 30, 40 years.
Yeah. Well, I just find it interesting because the lung, you know, it would tie in the spiritual aspect. The inspirar, the breath of life, it said that life force animating energy comes through the breath and, of course, is drawn in through the lungs, and that starts that whole process of the circulation. So that's, I don't know what that means. It's just amusing, Rick. It's amusing right now, mine, a little bit.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, it's intriguing too, you know, because the control of the breath and, you know, breathing exercises are, you know, instrumental in quite a few spiritual, you know, traditions around the world.
Right. Yeah. And so for it to be known to have been, you know, made there,
right.
I just feel something, there's some juxtaposition, there's some converging or coming together with these minds that perhaps at one point science will be able to not just prove the experience, but explain the experience, you know, I think people that are perhaps more consciousness or spiritually focused, a lot of times you're in that experience. And then there's pulling out of it to explain, to analyze, well, this is why this is happening. And maybe this is why this is happening on a physical or physiological level. For these kinds of experiences, I want to get your thought on this. For these kinds of experiences to happen more collectively or more in the mainstream, I think that there would have to be more explanation.
Well, yeah. Well, the experiences would kind of need to be, kind of medicalized as, in a way. It could be the topic of, conversation over breakfast or on, the Today Show,
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things. Yeah, so if we understand what's going on in the brain or in the body, I think it can kind of, make the whole thing a lot more palatable.
Yeah.
The understanding, though, is only one step or even the early step in, synthesizing, the two fields. I think ultimately the more important thing is, is the application
mm-hmm.
of these states, to be helpful, to as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of help would depend on the person. It mm-hmm. could be psychological help if they're depressed or anxious or have post-traumatic
mm-hmm.
stress disorder, or it could be spiritual help if somebody is a monk and is kind of stuck in their practice, or it could be some issues of creativity, what have you. But there's all kinds of new perspectives and new ideas which these compounds can stimulate in people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think once we can understand them, that they are that they're real phenomena, then I think it would be easier to be more comfortable in the application of them,
mm-hmm.
For any number of concerns.
Mm-hmm. What's almost taking, or would be taking actually, a shamanic point of view, that this is, if it was more codified or systemized as perhaps stages, or I like the term you use, also medicalized, then there would be some sense of consistency, or in a sense, this means this, or you could use this for this application, like you were saying, what an individual needed, whether like you said, depression or creativity. I agree with you, it would have to get to that level in order to be within our culture, our society.
This isn't a our culture isn't a, shamanic culture. And, for good reason, too. There's peer review, within Western science, and, there isn't in, shamanic, kinds of cultures. There's quality control. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
It could be better, but it's, kind of absent in, most shamanic cultures. It's, kind of every man for himself.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going, to need to turn, to our own strengths,
mm-hmm.
Rather than, kind of borrow and, make it up as we go along.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what's happening. it seems that it's a bit of borrowing from maybe those traditions, but how do we put it in a system that works, that you said, earlier, there's review, there's something, more systemized.
And also using terms that we understand, as opposed to, like a foreign language and a completely foreign culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've been, interested in the whole concept of the prophetic state.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is this whole, concept within the Bible of this state of consciousness, which is quite psychedelic.
Yeah.
It's described in terms that we know of, with characters you know, that we're all familiar with, like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, mm-hmm. and, you know, and Jesus and, you know, Moses and all of those kinds of people. You know, so I think instead of reinventing the wheel, you know, we've got the information under our,
Mm-hmm. Rick? Something happened on the phone. I don't know what happened. I don't hear him. Rick, can you hear me? Okay, not sure what happened, but somehow we lost connection with Rick, so we're called back in for the last little bit of the show. Technical difficulty, not sure. Rick?
Yeah, this is Rick, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure. All of a sudden it just slowed down and then, boof, just disappeared.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a lot of resistance to the idea of the prophetic state.
Yes, I know. I was just going to say that. I know they get into
Well, you know, the Bible, like, you know, most people, you know, like my friends, me, you know, you, all your listeners, you know, they're thinking about the Bible. They go, P-U. but, you know, it's our sacred text. And,
yeah.
And it's been around for a lot of years. And I think there's some good information in there, which if we view it from a different perspective or through a different lens, I think it might be mm-hmm. quite startling what is revealed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had on the program was Dr. Joanne Coleman, who has studied, I'm not remembering right now, the individual that studied with for quite a long time, but basically the Essene version, the Aramaic
right.
translation.
Right, right.
And
I think I heard about her.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, she's phenomenal. And there is a lot to be taken from there if you get, you know, as the closest translation that you can. And also what she says too, Rick, which is pretty to me amazing, but also common sense. If you understand the colloquialism of that time, if you get into what they were talking about and how they talked, a lot has been lost in translation. You know, and she gives an example. It's like if thousands of years in the future, people looked at us, well, we have, you know, things like, oh, that's cool. Well, then someone would think, well, they must have lived very cold. It must have been cold there. Or
right.
I'm up for that or I'm down for that. So a lot of, if for the colloquialism, then you begin to get the true meaning. As well as a lot of things were really wrapped in storytelling, because that's what they were. They were great stories. As she put it, is the ones that got listened to the most were the better storytellers.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I completely, you know, I completely am in I think understanding, you know, the language is quite crucial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've kind of taught myself, you know, to, you know, to be able to read the Old Testament. But you know, one of the aspects, if you do want to, you know, dig in, mm-hmm. you know, to the Bible as a sacred text, is you have to is that you need to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't depend on the clergy to,
mm-hmm.
you know, to translate, you know, because of, you know, their motivations, you know, which are, you know, primarily, you know, to maintain the clergy as opposed to, you know, expanding the truth.
Mm-hmm. You're saying you have to do your own research in a sense.
To do your own research. Yeah, yeah, there just isn't any, you know, you just really can't avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of like psychedelic drugs. You can take a psychedelic drug, but you know, like being back and you,
yeah.
you know, have this and you know this incredible experience. You know, but what do you do with it?
I agree. And you live
yeah.
it. Bring it into your
right.
everyday living. We're just
right.
a few minutes left. We've got a call. Let me see another one here. Hi, 310-480. You're on Awakenings with Dr. Rick Strassman.
Hi, Michelle. It's Lynn. I'm just away from home and listening.
Oh, wonderful, listening by phone. Great. Don't you just love technology? You can listen on your cell phone. Great. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that I'm not leaving anyone out. Now, the book coming out is based on prophecy, the one that you're working on now, right?
Yeah. I just started working on it, you know, because I have my deadline. But I've been, you know, I've been, you know, kind of poring over the Hebrew Bible for the last 13 years or so. Well, you know, I was interested in a model, you know, that kind of, you know, took into account the external reality of this of the spiritual realms. You know, that was one thing, and you know, Judaism as it is explained in you know, the Old Testament, you know, certainly does that. I was also interested in a culturally, you know, resonant, you know, system as well, you know, one that we could all relate to. You know, so the Old Testament, you know, is clearly the foundational, you know, text, you know, for all three of the major Western religions. You know, I began reading, you know, the Bible as a prophetic work. Either was received and or it was written down in a prophetic state. You know, so if you start, you know, looking at, you know, the Bible as a you know, work of you know, prophecy, and if you can, you know, think about, you know, the prophetic state as, you know, as like, you know, kind of a psychedelic state, then I think, you know, that would start a communication between, you know, science and spirituality in a means, you know, that doesn't, you know, it isn't hocus pocus. It isn't Zen. It's not jungle shamanism. It's not, you know, Taoism. It's our, you know, kind of bread and butter. It's been infused into our culture, into our arts, into our science, into our law, and into the government. You know, the Bible is you know, the West's sacred text. I think it could allow the discussion to really go quite a bit deeper into the interplay and interdependence of the spiritual and of the physical. You know, in a way that isn't possible if you're, you know, comparing, you know, a psychedelic state to either Buddhism or, you know, to shamanism, you know, which are the two most current, you know, models to understand and, you know, contextualize, you know, the psychedelic experience.
You're definitely a bridger. Definitely a bridger. Well, Rick, this has been wonderful. And I just want to touch in with everyone and let you know, because we have some other people that have entered and also online, but we are out of time. But if you'd like more information about Dr. Rick Strassman, you can go to rickstrassman.com. That's RickStrassman. And find out more about his work, his research, as well as his work and focus on the Cottonwood Research Foundation. Thank you, Rick, so much for being with us. We really,
okay,
this has been
a lot, Michelle.
Insightful and enlightening. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on Awakenings and being part of this converging flow. Awakenings airs every Wednesday and Friday at 12 p.m. Pacific time. If you'd like more information, you can email me at michelle@selfandlight.com. Or for updates, you can go to Awakenings Tweet. And that's Twitter. That's my Twitter handle. How's that? Always enlightening. Always great to see error and great to converge in this place of individual and collective awakening. So until next time, shine your light and keep awake. I think we're going to end with a little bit of Golden Sun by Thunderbeat from her latest CD called Ancient Sun.